Ali.
My guest has been Nicole Ashoff, editor-at-large of Jacobin magazine, where she writes about capitalism, technology, and labor. Her earlier book was The New Profits of Capital. We've been discussing her latest book called The Smartphone Society, Technology, Power, and Resistance in the New Gilded Age. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to temporary closure of in-station activity at KABU, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Personnel Committee meets on the second Monday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
David D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Wanted to talk to a good friend of the show, somebody no stranger to our airwaves and no stranger to you if you're around the country. He's an organizer, he's an activist, he's an author, a playwright, a freedom fighter. His name is Kevin Powell. And a lot of times we say the planet of Brooklyn and we're being affectionate and we always have fun, but now New York City is an epicenter and there's serious things going on, and we wanted to find out from him and his perspective what is happening and what we need to do. And we're talking about looking at the scenario that it has resulted in a disproportionate amount of death taking place in his country. The plague of the coronavirus has left a lot of folks in the Big Apple severely scathed, and Kevin has been on the front line chronicling a lot of this, and so we wanted to talk to him and find out how he's seeing things. So welcome to the show, Kevin. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on from your perspective.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it every single time. Just thank you, and greetings to your audience.
Good to have you. I know last week you had talked about going to maybe all five boroughs and really taking an assessment of what was going on. Can you share with our audience what you were seeing that's not necessarily being covered in the mainstream with these, news stories?
Well, absolutely. Myself and a great woman photographer named Kate Hickman actually spent 2 days documenting what's been happening on the ground in New York City. The first day we did go to all five boroughs, Staten Island, the Bronx, Queens, Brooklyn, and Manhattan. And the second day we went to four boroughs except for Staten Island. And it's striking because you see some folks wearing masks, some folks not wearing masks. You see overworked. We passed by a lot of hospitals, overworked staff, nurses, doctors, other folks who work in hospitals. A lot of folks outside smoking cigarettes, looking very stressed out. You see folks who are essential workers making their way around the city. You see a lot of homeless people on the subways riding the trains because they can now in a different kind of way, because a lot of folks are not on the trains except for essential workers. Unfortunately, you see a lot of people in poor communities, black and brown communities, working class communities, not social distancing, but you also see the Hasidic Jewish community not social distancing, which is why we've seen a lot of deaths in both those communities, both black and brown communities and the Hasidic Jewish community in New York City. And you see a lot of people struggling because they don't have work or they're out of work. And so people like myself who are organizers are mobilizing to make sure that people are getting food. I want to commend Jeffrey Wright, the great actor, for organizing relief efforts for essential workers, making sure that they get food delivered to the hospitals where they're working. I just started working with an organization called the Campaign Against Hunger, the Campaign Against Hunger here in New York, which is a legitimate organization that long before the pandemic had been delivering free groceries to housing projects throughout the five boroughs of New York City. And so they're actually upping that ante. And people will see that online later this week, where I'm going to be pushing folks to make donations so we can, we need to actually raise money to buy groceries for people for the next year, because we know the financial hit. Even as these states, California, New York, are starting to reopen, many folks are not going to recover. This is our version of the Great Depression financially for many of us. So these are the things that I've taken in, I've seen. Personally, I'm okay health-wise. I'm devastated, Davey, that I've lost a number of people to the coronavirus, including one of my college professors. A lot of people I know have been sick. People I know have lost fathers, mothers, sisters, brothers, children, parents, grandparents. I've had nightmares pretty much every night as I text you. It's almost to the point where I don't even want to go to sleep half the time, or like a lot of people in the country, you know, your sleep is off because it's very difficult to get into a rhythm with all this happening. It's a tragedy. There's no way to describe it. It's a global pandemic. That the worst thing I've seen before this, and you lived through it like I did, was the AIDS epidemic and the crack epidemic. The difference was that these things were still kind of isolated in certain areas. You know, whereas we don't know where this is, and it makes it very difficult to know how to navigate. I mean, for me in New York City, it's even effort emotionally just to go outside because you're just extra careful with the gloves and the mask. And meanwhile, you see people walking right by with no gloves, no mask, nothing on. And so it's a very, very surreal experience. And I just I wouldn't wish this on anybody. I love New York City. I love Brooklyn to death, as you know, but it is very difficult living in the epicenter. We've now lost in New York 19,000 people. We have over 300,000 confirmed deaths. And to put that in context, 319,000 confirmed cases of it. But to put that in context, New York is probably representing about a third of the confirmed cases in the country and also a third of the confirmed deaths in the country. That's how bad it is here.
One of the challenges that we have is that there are people that have been very aggressively saying this is not real. There are folks that had gone out with videos and said, look, there's not, the hospitals aren't crowded. Just from your own experience, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, you're a journalist, you're an organizer, an activist, and your word is bond, so to speak. You know, if you're coming up short with the receipts, then all credibility is gone. So you went to the five boroughs and you've seen this devastation. I'm just wondering why it's not translating in a way that is palatable for people to clearly understand that we're in a crisis. The fact that even in New York itself, you have people walking around with no masks, no gloves, almost like, well, This is my way of showing you that this is either one, overblown, or two, actually doesn't exist. We can look out here in the park where I'm across the street and see people walking around with the same disregard. And it seems to be a sharp contrast because I'm seeing some of the most vulnerable populations of people gloved up, masked up, and trying to go about their business, and others, you know, many of them gentrifiers where I'm at, who like couldn't give a damn. So why do you think there's this disconnect, and where's it coming from?
Well, that's a great question, an excellent question, Davey. There's a lot of things that I think about. One, you know, some of it is religious based, be it Hasidic Jews in New York City or even folks who are Christians, you know, feeling like, you know what, including my own mother, you know, she has said to me several times, you know, do you really have faith? You know, God got us. And so I think there's some of that, and I want to be respectful of that, you know, be it Christian folks or Hasidic Jewish folks, you know, and then feeling that, you know, there's a higher power that's going to protect them. But as I was taught, as many of us were taught growing up in the church, you know, God helps those who help themselves. And this is something that we need to be aware of, that, you know, I think it's actually irresponsible for any religious or spiritual leader or organization or church, temple, masjid, synagogue, any type of organization like that, to not encourage their followers, their members, to practice social distancing, to wear masks and gloves. That's number one. Number two, I believe that what comes out in crises like this are all the ills that already existed in the society. We know that America already was riddled with racism, with sexism, with classism, with homophobia, transphobia, all ableism, you know, the disregard for disabled people. We can go through the list of stuff. And you see that even happening when I see it in New York City. You mentioned the gentrifiers, we call them hipsters in Brooklyn, you know, white folks walking around, white brothers and sisters walking around like it's no big deal, because the word now is that this now is something that only belongs or is affecting black and brown people mostly. And so there's also this kind of this racial superiority even subconsciously comes out, like, well, we're good, we got this, you know. Meanwhile, you know, when I do see black and brown people not wearing masks and gloves, it's because when you think about poverty in this country, people are surviving. They were surviving before the pandemic, and so they're basically dealing with all kinds of isms coming at them at the same time, be it, you know, police brutality, racial profiling, you know, living check to check, you know, trying to figure out how to make ends meet, you know, the poor school system, all the things that are already a part of the systemic problems of society, you know, will lead to me seeing a group of black males, black and brown males, outside of a housing project in Harlem, standing 6 inches apart, barely, if that much, and no mask, no gloves, because they're like, yo, we already survived this stuff. What could be worse than what we already going through? You know what I'm saying? But at the same time, I have seen an increase here in Brooklyn of black and brown people wearing masks, because I think it's hitting home for some of us now. This is very serious, and we're being taken out. One of the best conversations that I've had, Davey, and please, your listeners can go to utneyreader.com later today, whenever they hear this show, utneyreader.com. I interviewed several people during the course of those two days going around the city. The most powerful conversation I had, or one of the most powerful, was with someone who was a grave digger, an Afro-Latino male, a worker, I should say, who works on Hart Island. You know the Bronx. You remember Pottersfield, Davey, from the Bronx, where they've been burying bodies that were unclaimed since the Civil War. And he said that most of the bodies coming into Hart Island are black and Latino people, Latinx people. That's what we're dealing with, you know what I mean? And so I think that's also why you see more of us saying, we've got to, man, I don't want to die from this thing, because you're seeing the stories. You go on Facebook, it pops up. You go on Instagram, the stories pop up. And I think there's an increasing awareness that if we don't protect ourselves, no one else will, which is exactly what happened during the AIDS era with Ronald Reagan, and that government turned its back on people who were suffering from the AIDS virus.
Kevin Powell, let me ask you this. Is this disproportionate amount of people dying, black and brown, in New York, is this a result of not having access to health care, looking at this governor who is being celebrated nationally, but internally we knew that in New York he was making all these drastic cuts, moving back essential services that are now needed urgently, and folks just don't have access? Or is there something that is really along racial lines, allowing black and brown folks to catch this virus and others not to?
Well, the question begs itself, you know, my rhetorical question for you and everyone else, when did America or this world actually ever care about poor people of any race or color, skin color, Black and Latinx folks, Native American folks, Asian folks, women, you know, disabled people, the LGBTQ community? When did it ever care about people who have historically been marginalized? That's the first question. Then number two, as someone myself who grew up in horrific poverty, as I've talked about on your show before, I know what resources did and did not exist for my single mother and me, you know, as we were navigating this stuff. I mean, my God, when I was growing up, I can count on my one hand, Davey, between the time I was born, my mother took me from the hospital, and when I was 18 and went away to college, only because of a financial aid package that was created during the Civil Rights era, I barely ever went to the doctor. We had Medicaid or Medicare, whatever we had, but you just didn't go. One, there was a lack of trust that, you know, we would be taken care of properly. Case in point, I have an article in the New York Times right now called In Close Quarters, a mother of six deals with the coronavirus. Her name is Mama Tanya. She's one of our most dynamic leaders in the city. She talked about even how she was giving birth to a couple of her six children, you know, the reckless racism and sexism that ended up scarring her body to the point where she decided that she was going to have the rest of her children, which she did, at home. And then we know for poor people, working class people, people of color, that going to the doctor actually means going to the emergency room, because that's the only option that we have, you know, for most of us in our communities. It's not, you know, a private doctor. It's not any of those types of things. And so when a global pandemic hits like this, it simply pulls back the curtain of the Wizard of Oz, what has always been there all along. As Michael Jackson said, they don't really care about us, which is why you're seeing people unable to get tests, why people are dying and being told, you know, before they died, you know, hey, you're okay, just go home and take some Tylenol and things like that. I mean, it's a reckless, this is like the Wild Wild West, baby, all over again with people's lives, where people are just really, it's like Russian roulette. You're just out there on your own. People are using home remedies. They're all going, when they see Queen of Fool on Instagram or someone else that, you know, seems to be helping with herbal medicine, people are desperate. Are absolutely desperate for answers on how can I make sure I don't die from this thing, particularly if I'm a Black or Latinx person, who are the groups that have been most affected by this, and Native American people, we should add, and especially people who happen to be poor. But we know that even in Prince George's County, which is the wealthiest Black middle-class community in America, in Maryland, PG County has record numbers of Black folks dying. And they have resources there. So to answer your question, it does appear, just like during the AIDS epidemic, the crack epidemic, that there are forces at play that simply do not care what is happening to people of color during a crisis like this.
Let me ask you this, Kevin. Kevin Powell is on the air with us this afternoon, if you're tuning in. We've been through this crisis. We're going through it now. Based upon your years of being an organizer, what would be a solutionatory path that you think we can take and really, you know, move things to the next level as this thing subsides? We have the benefit of history behind us. We've been through some things. The crack era is probably the most prevalent thing that I think has hit many in our community that they can look back to. What steps do we take that are going to be solution-oriented and really help us survive this and even thrive coming out of this?
I mean, you're asking such a wonderful question, Davey, as always. I just feel like it has to be a communal response. I mean, no one's going to take care of us except for ourselves. And when I say us, I really am saying we the people, Americans, because, I mean, let's be real about it. Even our white sisters and brothers have been dissed and disrespected during the course of this process. The ones who have been able to navigate it are people who have means, super means, you know, the Rita Wilsons and Tom Hanks, you know, who have been able to get around this thing even as they had the virus. But I think this is a wake-up call for America in general, New York City, New York, California, all of us, that it has to be a different approach. And I do think, even with people's criticisms of Gavin Newsom, your governor there, you know, you all are so far ahead of us in the rest of the country. The fact that the mayor of Los Angeles, you know, announced that there's going to be free testing for everyone in the city of Los Angeles. That's what should be happening all around the country. You know, the fact that the mayor of San Francisco, Mayor Breed, had the vision to shut things down, even as she was being criticized long before other people did it. That's the kind of visionary leadership we need. And so I think that the conversations that have to happen, and I'm speaking for a second directly to Black people in Black America, is, you know, enough of this focusing only on voting. We do know we need to vote. We do know this election is historic and important and all that kind of stuff. We do need to do agree that it makes a difference on some level if Democrats control the House and the Senate as opposed to Republicans, given the way the policies have gone for the last 50 years. But we also have to ask ourselves a question as Black Americans. Since the era of the Civil Rights Movement of Malcolm and Martin and Fannie Lou and Ella and all those folks, what's the Black agenda? And that's something that I've seen pop up a lot in, over the course of this pandemic, Davey, is like, what is the agenda? There is no agenda, you know, because we've been constantly reacting. I mean, you're right, I've been doing this for a long time. I was involved in the whole era of crack and AIDS and anti-apartheid movement, Hurricane Katrina. We went down there and did tons of relief work, many of us, back and forth, you know. And I remember even then having conversations with about 100 Black leaders on the telephone and trying to get, you know, some of us were trying to say, hey, y'all, instead of always reacting to crises, be it the earthquake in Haiti or Katrina down in the Gulf Coast, where's our relief? Where's our relief plan? Instead of relying on the Red Cross and these other organizations that we know take money, and most of the money never makes it to the people that actually need it, where's the relief fund for us? And so, you know, Lasana Hotep, our friend and our brother who's there in the Bay Area, which you says the best, if you're serious about helping your community, the most important thing you can do is to be prepared. And this pandemic has shown how woefully underprepared America is in general for anything, you know. And that's embarrassing considering this is supposed to be the wealthiest and most powerful country, quote unquote, in the world. And if America's not prepared, then it certainly means that Black people and Latinx people and Native American people and other folks who have been marginalized are woefully underprepared. And so we need to look at that, because our people should not be suffering like this, but we need to have a plan of action that's different. I mean, I'm sitting here, Davey, thinking about how people used to joke with me about my diet and the things that I do, but I'm like, you know what? My immune system is actually really strong, so I'm going to be okay, because I know that even the things – we don't even have a conversation about the things that we digest and how these things affect our bodies and make us vulnerable. My mom and my aunt, my two closest relatives, have diabetes, high blood pressure, severe arthritis. And so they're vulnerable. They have those pre-existing conditions that we're talking about. But no one ever had any conversations with them, not in their churches, not in their labor unions, any place, about, you know, being proactive with their lives. You feel what I'm saying? And so I think this is a serious wake-up call for a reset across the board. What is it that we're actually going to do to educate and empower people so they can be protected in different ways going forward, no matter what their income level, so they're not just vulnerable and basically sitting ducks like this, which is what we are.
That is the voice of Kevin Powell, if you're just tuning in. One of the other scourges that we're dealing with is police violence. And not that it stopped, but you would think that at this time, when we know that many police officers are, you know, have the virus and have been affected, and in some places they have died in numbers, that there would be some sort of recognition, and maybe that's just naive, of the humanity. What I'm struck about is seeing the side-by-side pictures of cops handing out masks in New York City to people who are sitting there, not social distancing, on a park. And they're giving out masks and gently telling them they have to practice social distancing. And then seeing them beat up, you know, people who are Black and brown, who are sitting there talking to each other. There is no, you know, gentle conversation. There is no mask being given out. Innocent bystanders are pummeled. What is this about, and what steps are being taken to even change that dynamic? And the case that I'm talking about involves a man named Francisco Garcia. He was a police officer with a long, ruthless record of intimidating and beating people, costing New York City lots of money, was just seen on tape in plain view, not only using racial epithets, but just beating somebody to the ground for asking what's going on when he saw police violence taking place.
Yeah, yeah. I just think that let me say this. In any truly progressive woke activist would say the same thing, I believe. We're not against police. What we're against is police brutality, police misconduct, police violence against a marginalized community. We're against police hatred toward our communities. That's what we're opposed to. You know, I have friends who are police officers. I have had family members who have been police officers. You know, that's not my issue. They know where I stand. I've been out there protesting and rallying against all kinds of cases of police brutality, misconduct for many, many years. I think, again, you know, I'm concerned. I see it in New York City. You asked me the first question, what are you seeing? I see some police officers driving around in their squad cars right next to each other. Some have masks on. The cars both have masks on. I've seen police officers where there's no mask, and I'm saying to myself, what's going on here? I've seen great kindness from citizens, residents here in New York City to our police officers and vice versa during this pandemic. The problem is this kind of stuff only happens when there's this tremendous crisis. The same thing happened 9/11. You know, people were like, oh my gosh, the police officers, the fire personnel, whoever it is. And then the moment the crisis is over, it's back to business as usual, which is probably what happened here, because the problem is systemic. It's systemic. It's deeply engraved in our society that certain groups of people have to be policed, quote unquote, and the other groups of people have to be policed. It started, it's rooted in something called slavery. It started and is rooted in something called the removal and mass genocide of Native American people. And it literally became police forces in this country. And so it's the same mindset, you know. And I think that, you know, again, none of this is going to shift, but I feel like what is happening, none of this is going to shift unless there's a serious systemic change here. And that's really what I think that this pandemic is doing to America. I mean, the irony, Davey, that this thing started, you know, allegedly in China, you know, in Asia, and it exploded in places in Europe like Italy. But the worst of it has now become to the United States. I mean, it's very profound what is happening. It's very biblical, you know, it's very deep to me. But I think it's also revealing to a lot of people, including folks who never even thought about this stuff, wait a minute, we've got some very, very serious systemic problems in America. Police forces, the medical system, how we treat workers, how we treat who are now called essential workers, how we treat people who live in inner city environments, black and brown people, you know, it's revealing everything, and how these elected officials are, many of them are not even intelligent. And then you also see the ugly racism coming out and the sexism with these folks storming the capital of the governor of Michigan, Governor Whitmer, with guns. Now, these are white men with swastikas. They're anti-Semitic, they're racist, they're sexist. He's a woman governor. All these different things are going on, and it's allowed to happen. You know what I mean? But we also have to be clear that Donald Trump is not the beginning of all of this. He's simply a continuation in the most ugliest and overt form of it, but it's always been there. It's always been there. You know, I say to people all the time, and you know this, Davey, the only difference between Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush is that they just did it with a smile. You know what I mean? That's the only difference. You know what I mean? Whereas with Trump, you get the vicious ugliness of these white supremacists because he himself is openly a white supremacist. And so the problem is the system. You know what I mean? And unfortunately, the police officers don't realize that they're even pawns in it because no one even cares about their lives at the end of the day. That's a fact.
Definitely something that we need to be thinking about. Kevin Powell, you know, we appreciate you taking time out this afternoon and sharing with us, you know, your perspective on this and some of the stuff you're covering. A couple of things before we go out. One, where can people read the article or see the pictures and the coverage that you've done? The second thing is, what would be the marching orders that you give to folks who are listening to us, whether we're here in Cali or the other cities that Hard Knock is heard in? What would be the two or three things that you ask them to do moving forward?
Well, first, and thank you for asking. So people can just Google my name and these five publications about the pandemic: the New York Times, Ms. Magazine, Utney Reader, UTNE Utney Reader, BT Digital. And also, Good Morning America. I did a letter to a young boy that I mentor who has been going through
That's
it.
That's right. I
like
forgot
many
about
children
that.
Are.
Talk a little bit about that letter. I completely forgot that you did that.
I wrote a letter. It's called A Letter to a 9-Year-Old Boy During the Coronavirus Pandemic. His mother is a single mother, like my mother was and is, and I've known the little boy since he was 5 years old, and we've become very close. He's actually in the documentary film that I'm working on. I've been working with him and helping him and trying to be a male presence in his life. And his mother called me and said that the little boy is going through depression, severe nightmares, is afraid to sleep alone, all these types of things. And I spoke to him on the phone, and I didn't feel that I adequately addressed what he was going through, and he was kind of clammed up at that moment. So I decided to put some things down on paper. I just wrote it. I didn't know where it was going to end up. I just wrote it from the heart and just said to him, look, the first lines of this letter are, I am scared too. You know, I understand what you're feeling. I have nightmares too. You know, I wanted to really write something that spoke to children, but also really spoke to all of us, no matter how old or how young we are, because I think we have to be honest that this is affecting us mentally. This is a traumatic moment in American and world history, a hugely traumatic experience for us, you know. And so it got picked up by ABC News and Good Morning America. I was shocked, to be honest with you. I wasn't looking for that, you know what I'm saying? But a lot of people have read it to their children and have been thankful for it. So people can go to Good Morning America website and look for that, like I said. And I'm just trying to create things that document, like you're doing, Davey, like you've done wonderfully for many, many years, documenting what is actually happening. Because this right here, what we're in the middle of, it's got to be the most insane thing that I've ever experienced. And I thought before that it was Katrina and 9/11, but this is on another level. And I lived through those things and participated in relief efforts of those things. And this is bananas, beyond anything I could have ever imagined. And so I'm just trying to help people navigate and cope as best they can, just like I'm trying to do myself as an activist and a writer. And in terms of what people can do, I just think that, you know, for myself, all I can say is I pray and meditate every day. I exercise every day. I stretch every day. I call people. I just want to hear voices in a different kind of way. Love and forgiveness are more important to me than ever. Just letting things go, you know, and I try to do my work as best I can. I check in with my family and family members around the country every chance I get. Every day I talk to a different family member if I can. And I think, you know, I'm careful. I think we've got to be careful. And I want to stress to people who are listening to you, you know, I believe in my heart, again, that California is one of the leaders in terms of how to deal with this thing. You know, I'm listening to what's being said there, what's being said by Cuomo here in New York, even as I'm critical of Cuomo not respecting all rights of prisoners who have minimal crimes, nothing that was violent, and still not being willing at first to let them out of jail. I mean, I just think that we've got to kind of gravitate toward the folks who are making sense around this thing. This is going to go in waves. You know, it's possible that this could go on for another year, year and a half, up to 2 years. We need to study what happened with the Spanish flu in 1918, 1919, that went on for 2 years. Even as they were playing things like the World Series in 1918, one of the umpires from the World Series in 1918 actually died from the Spanish flu. So I think that people need to be careful going forward. This is definitely a wake-up call that we've got to change our lifestyles, you know, that we can't do some of the things that we're doing. And I see people flocking to parks in New York, beaches in California. But we've got to be smart about this thing. You know, we've got to think about not just ourselves, that kind of selfishness. I want to be outside. I want to have fun. But anything that you do, this pandemic is reminding us that we're all connected to each other. So my drop of saliva could actually kill someone else if I have the virus. And we need to think about it like that. And that's what I think has to happen.
Kevin Powell, we appreciate you taking time out this afternoon. We will look out for your writings. We will check back with you to see how things unfold in the Big Apple. So we appreciate you, brother. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brother Dave. I appreciate you all. Have a blessed day.
We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock. Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program. Turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man. Chris Juwan Kim. Yeah. Innovation. Stimulating ill conversation. Anything else you just imitate. Simulation. Step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio. Let's go. Big shout out to Davey D. Yeah, right. Feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kind of crazy though. Yeah. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on. Check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't gone all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats, trying to eat till they're ready from the steel gray beats. Say please. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say some peace to their lovers, I name with a please. Hey, there's some shade on your name in the street. You go. But it ain't David D.
Real Talk Radio.
You and I rocking with the best in the West.
West Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
I just want to say that, you know, coming from across the pond, we've got a lot of really good radio in the UK, but there's nothing that compares to Hard Knock Radio. Wouldn't you agree?
Hello. You might know my voice from many things that you've listened to before in the past, before Morgan Freeman took all of my work. That's why I'm doing Hard Knock Radio. You can listen to it in Zamunda, you can listen to it in Brooklyn, or you can listen to it anywhere you want to hear politics, music, and anything else.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Joining us via Zoom, via the phone line, Andrea Pritchett, who is no stranger to our airwaves. Andrea, of course, with Cop Watch. And I wanted to have Andrea on because a few weeks ago, maybe about a week into the shelter in place, so this was back in March, an incident took place in Berkeley, and we were made aware of that incident in the beginning of April. And this incident involved a young black man who was up on Sacramento Street in Berkeley, who had his hands up and was shot by the police. Now, a lot of people didn't hear the story about it. It was a non-lethal weapon, so fortunately he didn't die. The video is disturbing because when you watch the video, you see the guy with his hands up and the police shoot him. And the story that came out was, well, first we couldn't find where he was and who he was. And then we started to hear stories about cop, you know, death by suicide or cop by suicide or killed by cop by suicide. I forget what it's called. But anyway, they were saying that basically maybe he wanted to be killed by the police. We wanted to follow up because in the wake of that, we've seen a tick in police violence from Sacramento with the 14-year-old being beaten to over the weekend with the young brother who was standing there watching these kids be harassed and said something to the cop. Cop called him an N-word and then started pouncing on him. This is in New York. Cops are wearing no masks and they were doing social distancing enforcement. So that's a whole other story which you'll probably hear about. Of course, the situation in San Leandro at the Walmart. There was a shooting by police of a black man in Cleveland who was driving a car. The police said it looked like he had a gun. This was an off-duty cop that shot the man and the teen who were in the car. The teen, you know, the car crashed, man died. And so, and then we have Austin, Texas, where you see a man running from the police and the police shoot him as he runs away. So there's been an uptick in this, and this is all during the pandemic. Wanted to find out from Andrea how you're seeing things, so welcome to the show. And let's start off with the case of William, I guess it's Dean Brown.
Yes, sir. Well, David, thank you so much for letting me be here and talk about these incidents in Berkeley, which so often get overlooked. So I really appreciate you putting a spotlight on this. And yeah, like you're saying, this incident happened on March 14th, and we became aware of it because somebody passing by just stopped their car, double parked, got out of their car and videotaped it and sent us the video. And it's really disturbing. It's an African-American man on his knees in front of a liquor store with his hands up, and he's having, you know, a couple words are exchanged, but the officers are arrayed in such, they, from the get-go, they're pointing a less lethal weapon at this man who has nothing in his hands. You know, it later turns out that he had a knife, he possessed a knife that he wore on his hip, on his belt, right? Mm-hmm. So we were obviously disturbed about the footage, but we care about making sure, you know, wanted to respect his privacy, we wanted to investigate, understand what happened. But what's really troubling is that I tried to get the public defender to tell me who this person was. I called the Berkeley jail. They acted like we had no right to know who they took into custody or how. Called the DA, nope, they're not gonna help. So for all intents and purposes, this person had been disappeared into the system. Mm-hmm. So we made the decision to go public with the video in an effort to try to identify the man and find out how he was and if he needed this video for his own defense against whatever charges might have been put against him. I also filed a Public Records Act request, again, trying to get this information. I was told that due to the coronavirus, that we could not expect Berkeley Police Department to respond to Public Records Act requests until maybe after the shelter in place was over.
Are you serious? Wow.
Yeah, yeah. That's what we were told. And it was not until we went public and we sent out press releases and so forth with the video that all of a sudden the chief of police is shocked into response. And respond he did. And what he did is, oh, suddenly they updated the information portal on the city's website that same day as the release of it. Hadn't been updated for months, but the day that we released that video, he quick updated it. But then he went on a full frontal, you know, press release. He took a still frame from and showed, you know, a person with a knife, you know, it's like a 3 or 4 inch blade. He takes a big photo, a life-size photo of the knife itself, and he selectively leaks this to Berkeley Side, a local pro-police newspaper that we have in Berkeley, which they dutifully said, oh, man with knife, you know, is taken into custody. The man was not in possession of the knife at the time. He was not wielding the knife. He was not threatening anybody with. He was shot with this, and they call it a less lethal weapon.
So a couple of things, if you're just tuning in, that's the voice of Andrea Pritchard from Cop Watch. The video is disturbing because you see about 5 or 6 officers surrounding him. The man is on his knees, it's daylight, his hands seem to be up, if I'm correct, in the video.
And they were, yeah.
Yeah, his hands are up. He's yelling something, and then he's shot. And a couple of things. That in itself, that visual is disturbing in itself because one wonders with that much power and force and backup that, what are the other options? So let's just say for the moment, well, Dave, at least it was a less lethal weapon, so he wasn't killed, right? That calls into question why that sort of tactic, that less lethal weapon, wasn't used to the man in San Leandro who was shot. You know, when you had similar amount of cops standing around somebody, in this case, a baseball bat, right? Mm-hmm. But let's go back to the situation at hand as to why this man was shot in the middle of daylight, why they didn't, you know, his hands were up. There were no crazy movements. What was going on? Is this the new way in which police get folks to comply if they're arguing? They just shoot him now with it and say it was a non-lethal weapon? Is that the new thing? Because we didn't see that used on Hasidic Jews in New York when they were crowded out and refusing to shelter in place. We didn't see this in Sacramento when people were coming up with rifles or in all these other state capitals. We don't see this in a lot of incidents. So what's going on here? And why are we seeing an uptick in these type of crime? I mean, these type of incidents with Black folks and police.
Well, what I can say, I mean, first of all, we just understanding the situation we're in, you know, with this shelter in place, it's like the police feel like they can do whatever they want to. They feel very empowered to, you know, they feel like they're not going to be witnessed. They're not going to be held accountable, that they can blame it on the virus and so forth. So that's...
So this incident happened before you had to wear a mask and we did all that. I think shelter in place just happened. So, but they were close enough. They weren't practicing shelter in place when they shot the guy. They were standing pretty close to him.
That's right. But what we also have to check out is this note that, you know, I really take issue with the term less lethal. Because what we have to remember is that even according to the manufacturer's guidelines, if you use those weapons in certain, if you hit in certain spots, you hit them on the spine, you hit them in the head, you hit them, so these can very easily become lethal weapons. So I call them potentially lethal weapons. So if you've got a situation, did that situation justify a potentially lethal response? And what the issue in that situation of the video is, the man is on his knees with his hands up. What he is objecting to is having to lay face down on the sidewalk. He has no idea why he's even being stopped. He had no idea. I talked to him later. He had no idea anybody called the police. You know, so all of a sudden he's surrounded by police being told to lay down. He's like, I'm on my knees with my hands up. What do you want? But nope. And I went back and I checked the dispatch tape. And from the time they got the call, you know, he said he repositioned his knife while he was in the store, that the guy took it wrong, et cetera, et cetera. And so called the police, like, oh, there's a man with a knife. From the time that that call went to the police to the time when they called they responded and said, we have used less lethal weapons, that was a 6-minute gap. So when the chief is coming back to me and saying, oh, we're so lucky that this didn't have a fatal outcome, it's like, slow up. All the training that your officers supposedly have, you didn't even put 5 minutes into talking to the guy or listening to the man. And the chief is saying, oh my gosh, he demonstrated signs of somebody who might present as a suicide by cop. Now, what that means is that they say that there's this phenomenon of people who want the police to shoot them, that some people who don't want to shoot themselves provoke police. They are using that to justify ever-increasing amounts of violence against people. Say, well, this might have been a suicide by cop.
And that's why I really wanted to have you on, especially after the things that are popping up in Austin and the thing popping up in San Leandro. That seems to be the new playbook. And basically, you can infer that if somebody doesn't comply. So in this case, as you pointed out, this gentleman, William Dean Brown, was on his knees with his hands up, and they wanted him to lie face down on the concrete. Now, for the record, you know, you're surrounded by 5 cops. Sometimes you can't literally lie down. I know I have an injury right now. I couldn't lie down that easy. I'd have to kick my legs out and do all kind of things because, you know, I have a torn situation in the back of my legs. It wouldn't be able to happen. Some people are older, can't do it. Some people don't know how. Some people don't want to go there because they're like, I don't want to put my face in dog feces and other things, right? But if the man has his hand up and you're surrounded, and if you see the video, I mean, they're surrounded like it's a football team, why are you shooting him? And so now the excuse, you know, well, he didn't comply, it was suicide by cop. He didn't comply in San Leandro, must have been suicide by cop. So that becomes the new playbook. How are you all as a police organization an organization that monitors police, how do you start to counter that? How do you start to deal with that? And how do we look at this in the wake of the new law that's passed that talks about the instances where you can use lethal force that's been modified? So is this a workaround for the police to say that, you know, he basically wanted to get himself killed, so we had no choice?
Well, that's what it seems like. But, you know, I what I really want to expose to as many people as possible is the sort of this fallacy that the police are putting out around so-called de-escalation. Now, I used to be on the Berkeley Police Review Commission. I was there for 2 years. I heard Sergeant Fombi, their de-escalation expert and so forth, and I heard his whole presentation. And in the police mind, if they don't use live ammunition, they consider it to be de-escalating. If all they do is shoot you with a rubber bullet or shoot you with a foam round, they feel like they de-escalated the situation.
Wow.
They get a grand total. Officers who are supposedly crisis intervention trained, now bear in mind, that's maybe 8 hours. You know, so what did you learn in 8 hours? And that is why I quit the Police Review Commission, I joined the Mental Health Commission, because what we need to do is to minimize citizen contacts with police, period, and not have them, you know, this notion of de-escalation. You know, they're not competent to do that, and that's not what they're doing. Militarizing relative just patrols. They're walking around with less lethal weapons. They're just swaggering around. I've seen it many times. They came into a homeless encampment a couple weeks ago. Somebody had stolen a bicycle. So they come in with less lethal weapons. Like, they, you know, that was supposed to be a crowd control weapon. And now they're using it in daily patrols.
Wow. What can people do, you know, to help? You know, what would be the marching orders that you ask our listeners to do that are concerned about this? What are next steps?
In the long arc of things, you know, I say minimize citizen contacts with the police. We're trying to cultivate alternatives. We're trying to, you know, mental health or.
But does that empower police when they go, you know, we got the public so scared they don't want to talk to us? That seems vastly unfair. Our tax dollars are paying for them.
I'm talking about rebudgeting. I'm talking about repurposing money that has been going to police. We're about to face a time of great cutbacks and budget crises in California and across this country. And we're going to have to fight like hell to make sure that those monies are not wasted on bloated police budgets and bureaucracies and actually go to serving the people who really need it. But short of that, I encourage listeners, just like this, but we wouldn't know that Mr. Dean had this situation unless people had just taken it upon themselves to stop and watch and record. And it takes a lot of courage to do that in this environment of like shelter in place and is it legal for me to. And I also really want to push on this notion like, okay, the police are so busy doing what that they can't respond to a Public Records Act request. Why do they get a pass every time? How does this is a medical emergency. This is not a police emergency. So, you know, what are they doing? They're telling people to put a mask on, like what? And so not to let them use the current crisis as a cover up. We really have to be on our game around this, holding them accountable. Like if you snatch somebody off the street, you better put their name in the jail log and we better be able to find it. And now if I see somebody get arrested at 5 o'clock at night on a Thursday, you know, March 15th, I damn well better be able to go down to that police station or call them up and say, who did you snatch? That's public records. And what, you know, those of us who went through like the Central America, the death squads of, you know, El Salvador and this kind of stuff, we know that police departments, if they're not held to check, they can deteriorate into these kinds of very dangerous entities. And once you lose control of them, it's much harder to get it back than it is to hold them accountable now.
Andrea Pritchard, we appreciate you taking time out and updating us on this. How do people get a hold of Cop Watch?
We're on Facebook. We also are at www.berkeleycopwatch.org. Please share out with us if you are concerned, especially around Berkeley-related incidents and mental health incidents, militarized policing. Look us up. We do Know Your Rights trainings. We'd love to get people trained up.
There you have it. We will keep abreast of this as we've been following a number of these cases. We're going to be following up with the case in Sacramento sometime this week, either tomorrow or the day after. And there's an uptick in this, and we're starting to see this during the time of this pandemic. And folks should not go to sleep on it. We should definitely be holding anybody and everybody who has any sort of influence or decision-making power accountable, especially with these who have been given a badge and a gun. So Andrea Pritchard, thank you so much.
Thank you, Davey. Thanks so much.
We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
What does it mean to be sheltered in place if the place you sheltered in don't feel safe? And how do we become so qualified to judge and chastise and lose the ability to empathize with those who don't feel safe inside for whatever reason? You know, you sometimes ain't got the luxury of feeling safe at home when you ain't got a safe space to call your own. No privacy, no courtesy, no bed, nor peace of mind. You're grateful for a roof over your head, but that's not where everybody spends their time. So by this time, you're already mastered trying to stay out the way. And you already overheard chatter about not overextending your stay. And trying to find resources hard without a computer or Wi-Fi. Plus, employment opportunities are scarce and local businesses are boarded up. So you being honest with yourself, asking like, why try? And it's not that everybody who's outside right now is even trying to be selfish. You know, some don't even want to be outside. They're just trying to avoid the insult of being displaced inside. You see, there's a lot of uncomfortable going on. And despite what you see on your timeline, not everybody's dancing to the same song. You know, some are dancing to the tune of loneliness and some ain't dancing at all. Some have their phones glued to their face and some ain't got no phones at all. No homes at all. No clocks on the wall. No time at all. No TikTok. No selfies. No hashtags. No memes. No statuses with complaints about how much food they overate. You know, some are still trying to find a meal and some are still trying to find their meal. I saw a broken car glass on my run around the block today. I must got a lot running through my mind today. Probably an indicator that I need to be still and pray, but the fact is we are all in this together, and the ones who judge and lead without love must not know no better. The world's lungs are under attack, and we're wasting precious breath on judgment, conspiracy theories about the government. Remember, We don't all have the same privilege when it comes on to access to information, and we're not all watching the same station. And after 10 years as an administrator in special education, I can tell you we all learn different. Matter of fact, it's time for a deep breath. It's time for a reset. Creatives, be gentle with yourselves. It's okay to take a break. Your value as a person is not defined by the art you create. Some of us are called to be light, and all of us are called to be salt. Preserve your well-being. Let love and kindness be your currency. Let Christ's compassion lead the way. And despite what economists say, empathy is the new wave, and it's the same as the old one too. It's all cyclical. And if you believe that money makes the world go round, then yeah, this standstill can be scary. But there are those of us who learn to speak without talking and move without walking. This is a journey to the inside. No more sweeping it under the rug. That rug is filled. And yes, the pain is present, but the love is real. So, today I'm gonna be patient with myself. The goal is to be present, not perfect. And parents, you don't have to be perfect. This ain't no normal homeschooling. Your children can feel the world's stress. And under such circumstances, no one learns their best. And you are doing your best. And might I add, a damn good job? And so are our essential workers too. And right now, I'm gonna say a special prayer for our social workers and educators too. And all the folks doing food accessibility work, I see you. Three black chefs in Meadowview, I see you. And I thank you from the abundance of my heart. And for our families with loved ones behind bars, I know this season is hard. So I don't want to offer any platitudes or throw any out-of-context scripture your way. And for those of us who've lost loved ones to the virus, we lament and pray. We are experiencing a collective grief to a scale none of us have ever seen before. Be gentle with yourselves. Do not harden your hearts. It may be Christ knocking at the door.
Somebody help me, set me free. I can't take this new reality. How much longer can it be? Where's the humanity? I look around and all I see, masked faces staring at me. Keep your distance, don't touch me. Get your hands off my TP. Somebody save my sanity. The COVID killer's coming after me. How much longer will it be? Where's the humanity? I'm sick and tired of staying at home. Even worse, I live alone. Gotta get out, I need to roam. You can't shake hands on the phone. I need to touch, I need to feel. I need to hug a friend for real. I'm not down for this new deal. I'm not down for this new deal. The COVID killer keeps piling it on. Counting the dead goes on and on. We gotta stay safe, gotta be strong. Ride this out no matter how long. There's no borders, there's no walls. Alone together, we stand, we fall. Around the world, hear the call. Alone together, we stand, we fall. Somebody help me, set me free. I can't take this new reality. How much longer can it be? Where's the humanity? Somebody save my sanity. The COVID killer's coming after me. How much longer will it be? Where's the humanity?
KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Also heard at Translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM and Translator K282B.